and power is power. But it just depends on how much power is getting to your antenna, if that's what you're referring to.
I'll say it again. Think about it in two different types of situations. You have a perfect antenna that's perfectly resonant and it doesn't reflect any power that's really measurable, but your transmission line has a loss of 1 dB. Or you have a case where you have a very large coax and your transmission line is negligible going up to your antenna, but the antenna is at a resonance and it gives you 20% reflected power, which is down, what, 21% would be about 1 dB. Would your signal strength radiated in the air be the same in both cases? Back to you.
Let me think about that, because I'm trying to digest the way you're explaining it. So I'm not going to give you an answer, since you have, I gotta just get a little bit of clarity on what you're asking before I answer the question. As far as you know, the way you asked it. Roy, do you have any comments on that?
AC2GS. Yeah, Joe. You know, all things being equal, if it's a perfect transmission line, then the reflected power isn't lost yet. You can still retrieve that 20%. So that would be different.
WA2VDH would a comment?
Why would it be different? If you don't have an antenna tuner in your particular application that can tune out the, or re-radiate it, if you don't have that working for you, in one condition where you had a transmission line with very low loss, but you had 20% power being reflected back to the antenna, or another case where your antenna is perfectly resonant, giving you no reflected power measurable, but you had a 1 dB line loss in the transmission line, wouldn't your radiated signal level over the air still be the same as measured in field strength at a given distance? Back to you.
Well, there was nothing in that, in the original one that mentioned no antenna tuner, but again, I would assume that this is reflected power that could possibly reflect back and forth and back and forth. So some of it's going to find its way up in this very theoretical, lossless transmission line. But John wanted to say something as well.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to, as I see it, okay, you have a transmission line with 1 dB loss and a perfectly matched antenna. And in the second case, you have a transmission line with 0 dB loss, but the antenna is generating, has a standing wave ratio where it is reflecting the power, as you say, reflecting 20% of the power. I'm going to assume that there's no re-reflection occurring at the source, that is, any reflected power is absorbed and not re-reflected, as often happens with antenna. In that case, I would say that both cases would be the same. If you launched 100 watts into the line with the 1 dB loss, okay, so 80 watts gets to the perfect antenna and gets perfectly radiated. In the other case, you launch 100 watts and it gets down to the antenna, 20 watts gets reflected, 80 gets radiated. So I would think that they would both cause the same measured field strength. Go ahead.
And Y2H. And then with N2HCN.
Okay, let me get the station that checked in, NY2H. I got you, and Wesley was back. Okay, let me give it to Lou. Go ahead, Lou. What's your take on this?
Hey, good evening, everybody. Now, I'm just doing this intuitively, so it may be wrong. You can attack it. But if you think about why that antenna might be out of resonance when you have a perfect transmission line, lossless line, is it because it's slightly long or it's slightly short? In which case, the radiation resistance would be different. And I think the longer, if it's out on the long side, your radiation resistance will be a bit higher. Given the same ground losses, you probably have a slight infinitesimal gain in the field strength. But that's just a gut feel. I have nothing to back it up with.
How about selling me that lost line? I'll pay good bucks for it.
Okay. All right, that was Ed. WB2EAV, do you want to add to this?
Let me just say, this sounds a lot like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, comparing different total hypotheticals. Yeah, there will be a point where you feel strength due to one will match the feel strength to the other, but I'm not sure what practical application this has. WB2EAV.
Okay. I gotta think about the the actual concept of what Joe's trying to convey. But the actual the gain of the antenna doesn't change. It has nothing to do with the SWR. If you have a mismatch to the antenna, well then if you'll have reflected power coming back, if you won't have as much power reaching the antenna because some of it will be reflected back, but the gain stays the same for whatever the gain is of the antenna, as opposed to just losses in the feed line. And feed line does not have any gain. There's no feed lines that have gain. They all have losses to some degree. So that's why it's a little bit tricky to understand that. All right. Again, my time is limited. We could talk about this and kick it around, but it's after 9. I want to get a little discussion on S-meters, if that's okay. And Jerry brought up a good question there. To be continued, let me just give it to Wesley, because Wesley, you had something you wanted to add to this, and then we can move on. W-A-2-C-D-O.
Tim, I have a great respect to you, and to thank you very much for your addition to the subject. But the decibel is logarithmic unit measurement that express the magnitude of the physical quantity, usually, yes, that's power or intensity, is relative to the specified implied reference level. It is logarithmic in nature, and its nature allows very large or very small radius to be represented by a convenient number in a similar manner to scientific notation, since it expresses a ratio of two quantities. But the problem that I have with you is you said I'm taking you out of track. Well, guess what? Decibel or dB doesn't exist without the physical quantity. So when I was talking about the receiver, about noise, I was talking about the implied reference, or I would say physical quantity in reference to to implied value, if you understand my English. And to
explain. Okay, alright, no problem. We could get into that discussion as far as receivers and noise figures of receivers and so on, because it's all related to the decibels when you get down to it, because the decibel is the actual number of a certain quantity, just like you said. So yes, looking at it that way, I agree. That's true. All right, I just didn't want to get too deep into it because trying to understand decibels in the first place could be a little bit confusing. So, very good. Thanks for that. Let me give it back to Roy, and then just to see if Roy, if you have anything else you want to add to that, and then I'll just go into a little S-meter discussion, and we'll go from there. WA2CDM.
AC2GS. No, I'm fine, Andy. I think Joe got kind of esoteric, and as Ed mentioned, it was kind of like how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. This is a theoretical construct, and we can all build theoretical constructs. In this one, in a perfect universe, there is no attenuation loss, which obviously there is, but for the sake of that, but also the experiment adds in the fact that there's no further reflection off of the antenna. I would assume that if it had a reflection off the antenna, it probably should have a reflection when it goes back to the transmitter stage. But again, you pick up, you pick your theoretical construct. So I'm fine with it all. I just want to remind people, I know that I mentioned the chat room in the past, once again. I'll mention that we're having a kind of parallel conversation about the same subject on the, in the chat room. So anyone curious, if you want to get there, you just type in chat.ac2gs.com. So that's all I wanted a little add to the mixture. So back to you, Andy.
Okay, very good. I'm glad I opened up this sort of can of worms of decibels. And you could get, you could get deep into the subject, and deeper, and you know, where it winds up, who knows? It's just an overview of what trying to get the concept across of what dBs are. The people don't know. Just like I'm going to talk about an S meter, because both radios have S meters, and what is the S meter actually telling you? Well, an S meter is basically signal level or signal strength, and it's just an indicator, you know, which gives you the level of the signal that's coming into the receiver. And the markings are actually in dB numbers, because it says on most S meters in dB. Bar graphs don't have that, I don't believe. There was a thing, it's scaled in what's called an S unit, and that actually came from the older system reporting signal strength, which is the RST system that was used, for measuring signal strength of even in using CW, you use RST. And let me just see here. So the term S unit can be used to refer to the amount of signal strength required to move an S meter indication from one marking to the next. So, basically, a technical description of this: analog S meters are usually sensitive. They're microammeters, is what they are, with a full-scale deflection of 50 to 100 microamps. So, so when you think about it, 50 to 100 microamps—that's pretty. That's a sensitive meter. In AM receivers, the S meter can be connected to the main detector or use a separate detector at the final IF stage, and that's in a receiver. This is a preferred method for CW and single sideband receivers. Another approach, in the days of electronic tubes, tube radios, was to connect the S meter to the screen grid circuit of the final IF amp, and, a third system, or third option, is to connect an S meter to the AGC line through a suitable
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Okay, WA2CDO. This is just mentioning where an S meter is normally connected to. Most receivers that I've worked on had the S meter connected to the AGC line, which is the automatic, that AGC is automatic gain control. And the AGC line varies with the signal strength. The AGC voltage varies with the signal strength of the signal coming in, and what that does, automatic gain, so your receiver does not overload, it reduces the gain of the stages as the signal that's coming into the receiver increases or is increased. So that's known as AGC, and that's a convenient place to put a meter on that circuit, or in that circuit, that would correspond to that level of the signal, or be calibrated to the level of the signal that's coming into the radio. So, it turns out in the 1930s, it was already agreed that S9, and this is another important point, the S9 on your meter corresponds to 50 microvolts at the input terminal of the receiver. But it says this was not a measure of the power received, as the input impedance of receivers was not standardized. See, now, if we're looking into a 50-ohm system, which we are, in this particular case, you know, we could say that it's a 50 microvolts in a 50-ohm system. And that's what we use in most cases. It also turns out that there is a different calibration. The International Amateur Radio Union, which is known as the IARU, Region 1, agreed on a technical recommendation for S-meter calibration for high frequency and for VHF and UHF transceivers. And this came out in 1981. So, again, technically speaking, the technical recommendations defines S9 for the high frequency bands. So if you have a reading of S9 to a receiver input power of -73 dBm, and there's actually a chart which converts dB to microvolts for a 50 ohm system, and it turns out that -73 dBm is just about 50 microvolts, and they came up with the standard as an S9 of 50 microvolts. So when you see an S9
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, let me wait to CD out. Let me let it drop, make sure I had the beep. When you see a signal coming in at an S9 level, if it's a good and calibrated 50-ohm system, and that's important, it's got to be 50, it's calibrated to 50 ohms because dBm is calibrated to whatever impedance that it's calibrated to. And in this case, a 50-ohm system, which corresponds to -73 dBm. As a 50 microvolt signal giving an S9 indication. So, it turns out for the VHF band, you see there was an addition to this. I'm talking about HF, but for VHF, the recommendations defined S9 to be a receiver input power of -93 dBm. And that's equivalent to 5 microvolts into 50 ohms. So this is a standard that they came up with. And this was in 1984. So it's not really that old as they standardized the impedance for measuring signal power, giving according to the S units that you're receiving the signal at. So, the recommendation defines a difference of one S unit corresponds to a difference of also 6 dB, which is a voltage ratio of 2 or a power ratio of 4. Now again, if you go back to your decibel formulas, which I gave earlier, 10 times the log, if you plug in the numbers, you'll see that you'll see a dB, a difference of 6 dB, which will give you a voltage ratio of 2 to 1. Or, if you use the power formula, it'll be 4 times the power. So, if you increase your power by 4 times, basically, you know, what it's saying, you'll see a 1 S unit change. So if you're putting out 1 watt, and you change your power to 4 watts, you're changing it by 4 times the power, That'll increase your S units on your OS meter by only one S unit. So you'll go from like S7 to S8, which is, again, as far as the voltage ratio, it's doubling the voltage. So signals stronger than S9 are also given with an additional dB rating.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, WA2CDL. I think I'm getting the most timeouts tonight. Lou, if you're listening, I think the timer was shorter last week. I think it so seemed that way anyway. Either that or I'm just talking too fast. So, signals stronger than S9 are given with an additional dB rating. Thus, S9 plus 10 dB or plus 20 dB or what have you. And that's the way S meters are normally calibrated. A weak signal with a signal strength of S2, so if you have an S2 reading, corresponds to received power of minus 115 dBm, or an equivalent to 0.4 microvolts RMS into the impedance 50 ohms, and that's on HF. So a strong signal with a signal strength of, let's say, S8, corresponds to received power of minus 79 dBm. And as I mentioned earlier, it's going to be a 6 dB change, because if S9 is minus 73 dBm, and S8 is minus 79, that's 6 dB, so one S unit change. You're going from S8 to S9. So they're just using this as an example. So S8 corresponds to receive power of minus 79, or 25 microvolts instead of 50 microvolts. Now your signal is half the received voltage. Instead of 50 microvolts, you're now 25 microvolts, and so on. So S8 and S7 will be another 6, another half, and then so it'll be an S7 will be, instead of 25, it'll be 12.5, and S6 will be 6.25 microvolts, and so on and so forth, getting weaker and weaker, halving each time. Any questions on this so far, the way I described this? WA2CDL. All right. So there's a chart. If anyone is interested, you can do a Google search on this, and it gives you your S9 plus 10 dB reading in microvolts, your dBm reading, and the signal generator level that's above 1 microvolt, and that would be a different value. And that's if you're using a signal generator, pumping in a signal into the receiver at a certain level, and that's on this chart as well. So, just to summarize this and just to button this up, most S meters on traditional analog receivers are not calibrated, and in practice can only provide a relative measure of signal strength based on the receiver's AGC voltage. And that's why I said AGC earlier. See, most S meters are not really accurate. You know, if you made a measurement, you would see it doesn't really follow. The better receivers like Collins do follow these rules more closely, where if you put in a 50 microvolt signal, you'll see an S9. If you put a 25 microvolt signal, you'll see an S8. If you put a 12.5 and so on, you'll see an S7. It'll follow. But most, even the Kenwood receivers that I've seen, even on the TS940, it follows it to a degree, but it's not that accurate. It's not the the linearity, the way I can see it, or say it, the linearity of the dB scale is not really linear. Even though it's a dB scale, or the linearity of the log is not exactly what it should be. So the log is not linear across the scale, if you know what I'm saying. So, one area that I'm not familiar with because I'm not playing around with is the software-defined radios. Because they process signals differently. And they determine S readings by a more direct measurement than RF amplitude. So consequently, many SDR systems with bit depths of 14 bits or more can accurately calibrate from one end of the scale to the other right out of the box. So in cases where this is not so, a few minutes with a single generator set to a reference level is all that's required. So you're dealing now with software defined, and you're dealing with bit rate, so you can compensate for errors, and you can have a much better count.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
At a 50-ohm input. And that's important because the impedance is important because it'll be calibrated to a 50-ohm system. And that's not the antenna, and it says that. So maybe this is what Joe was getting at before. See, in these receivers, it's going to the impedance of the receiver, not the antenna. So we're not looking at the antenna at all. If the antenna has a mismatch and it's not looking into it, it doesn't see 50 ohms looking into the antenna. So, for example, if the radio's input is 50 ohms, but the antenna's impedance is significantly higher, the power transfer from the antenna into the radio will suffer, and the signal levels will be lower than if they were fed to the input with a matching high impedance. Many antennas vary in impedance over various frequency ranges. Let me just let it drop. Particularly in the case of wideband designs, what is useful to know is that the relative signal strength at any one frequency will remain meaningful even if they are not from one frequency to another. So that is basically dealing with software defined radios and how they're calibrating. Alright, so basically this concludes, you know, my little verb on S meters and any DB discussions for tonight. We can continue this next week. I do have another article that I printed out. It's a practical guide to DB calculations, and it's a number of pages that we can talk about that next week. But it's 9:30, and I gotta get moving because I got stuff to do. So, any other questions before I depart? And we can continue this if anybody wants to next week. Not a problem. This is WA2CDO.
WB2KWC with a question.
Ken, my computer's working fine. Just thought I'd say that. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. I'm wondering if RST or S meters are going to be relevant going forward. I'm looking at some of the digital modes, FT4, FT8, Whisper, JS8. They're all now just giving real numbers, like I'm 30 dB below the noise level, or I'm 10 dB above the noise level. So I'm wondering if RST will be relevant in the future.
Yeah, that's a good question, and sort of parallels what I just mentioned about software defined. Only because of the accuracy, you know, when you have you convert an analog to a digital signal, you can now compensate the errors and recalibrate, and that's what it said here. I'm not too much in the digital modes as of yet. Eventually I will be. Roy is more versed on that. He's got some nice digital equipment that maybe he could say, with his SD, the readings that he sees, and how well he is calibrated. But that is a good question, and it may be more relevant as time goes on. I would think so. So before I give it to Roy, that's my answer on that. Ken, back to you.
Okay, Andy.
I guess we'll have to see what the future
holds. I guess we'll have to see what the future holds for us.
There's always these changes coming about. It's so hard to keep up with these changes. Okay, very good. Anyone else before I turn it back to Roy? Okay, thanks everybody for signing in and joining my little corner. So, we'll continue if you would like to do that next week. Roy, thanks again, and I'll give it back to you, and you can add to anything that I just mentioned, especially software defined. AC2GS, WHCDL.
AC2GS, thank you very much, Andy, for Andy's corner. It was a very stimulating experience, and if you have nothing better to do at some point, check out the chat room. There was a bit of a parallel conversation as they were listening and feverishly typing away. So I once again want to thank you for making the TechNet a little bit even more special than usual. So thanks a lot, Andy.
Okay, no problem. We'll see you next week.
Okie doke. And to give my 2 cents worth to Ken's question, I have a Flex radio. I pretty much tell everyone I have a 6700. It's a lovely little software-defined radio. It defines a power received in either DBM or translated into S units. Right now, these days, I have it set for DBM, and I can tell you that LIMAR comes to me at anywhere from minus 85 to minus 87 DBM. As Ken mentioned, there's a lot of software out there that can interpret their signals and calculate a difference between the noise floor and the peak of the signal. But that's a relative and calculated. It's not quite as accurate, although it's very, very useful, and I assume people will be using it a lot more. I think that as software-defined radio technology permeates amateur radio, most S-meters will go away from approximations based on gain settings and AGC settings and have direct reading. So S-meters should be a better thing in times to come. Okay, once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and I am the host tonight of the LIMARC Technical Net. If you have any questions related to that, and keep in mind that for the most part, save your questions for Andy when he comes back next Sunday for another edition of Andy's Corner. But if there's any subject that you wish to bring up tonight here, please give me your call sign and your first name.
WA2VDH with a quick question, Roy.
Yes, John.
On your software-defined radio, can you read the background noise directly in DBM? Can you read actually what the incoming noise level is in DBM? Go ahead.
Yes, I can. If you ever do a Google search on Smart SDR software, it basically gives you a very lovely pan adapter display of a range of frequencies, and on the right-hand corner is a sliding scale of a DBM, and so you can see where it intersects accordingly, and that's the base noise level.
And you can also define the measuring bandwidth that essentially what the bandwidth is of your received channels. So you're getting amount of noise power in a certain bandwidth channel, I assume. Go ahead.
Yeah, it depends upon the receiving frequency bandwidth. It's flexible. It's kind of locked down per FM used to 15. But especially for single sideband and amplitude modulation, it's kind of open, and you can adjust it at will and then get that average measurement.
I was just curious how it compares to the actual, I guess it would be the Gaussian level of noise of minus 174 dBm per hertz as you widen up the bandwidth, how much additional atmospheric noise you have above that lower bound of level. Go ahead.
Below 30 megahertz, atmospheric noise dwarfs that.
Okay, just to give you a little indication, the background noise, even if I were to disconnect to my transmission line, the lowest reading I've gotten on my receivers is a minus 120 dBm.
Yeah, so that's the additional noise generated by the circuitry. Depending on the bandwidth, but you're not going to get anything close to the actual bottom level of minus 174 dBm per hertz. Actually, if you for a 5 kilohertz bandwidth at room temperature, the Gaussian bottom level is minus 137 dBm, so you still have additional noise above that. Go ahead.
WB2EAB.
Yes, Ed, recognized. Just one comment. Yeah, I mean, for what it does, I mean, it's a beautiful machine, but it's certainly not a perfect machine. I remember I used to have conversations with Dick, K2RIW, may he rest in peace. And he was kind of amazed that the silicon, the chips, weren't melting down with the type of bit fiddling that they needed to do to get the job done. But, you know, it serves me well. Ed, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, well, when you're talking about Gaussian noise, yeah, that's true. And any deviations, given the bandwidth, now it depends entirely on the bandwidth. But as you said, given the bandwidth, you can calculate the noise floor. Then you add the receiver noise figure to that. And then as any cable losses, add directly to the receiver noise figure, which is why on some microwave front ends, little long coax, I put a preamp up at the antenna to get around that. And at frequencies below around 30 megahertz, the noise floor is 100% atmospheric. The Gaussian noise is totally lost in the source.
Well, yeah, Ed, I mean, and that's why preamps are good in one group, but not terribly good in the other, because the preamp is just going to amplify the noise that you had in the first place.
Yeah, the rule of thumb is there's no percentage in putting a preamp at the receiver unless you have a terrible noise for your front end. Preamps are very good at the top of a long run of coax.
Yeah, I agree, Ed. Wesley, you wanted to say something?
I just caught the discussion with Wolfside told me when you put the preamp next to the antenna, you're amplifying signal, not the noise. When you put the preamp next to the receiver, you're amplifying noise and the signal. So the ratio is worse, I told you.
Well, I mean, I think you're amplifying noise as well because there's background noise in the antenna itself. You can't say that the antenna is totally free of background noise. I mean, if you work in 80 meters and lightnings are firing all over the place, it's mostly in your antenna where you're picking up that stuff.
Absolutely disagree. Think of it this way. You have an amplifier, and you're putting amplifier next to the antenna. Or you have amplifier, and you're putting that amplifier next to the transmitter. What is the difference? Now, reverse that. You have a pre-amplifier next to the antenna, and you have a pre-amplifier next to the receiver. Do you see the difference? Do you see the point?
The point is... Hang on, drive it. All right, Roy, you're talking atmospherics. I think Wesley's talking Gaussian noise. They're oranges and apples. Actually, they're more like oranges and elephants. But the point for a preamp is if you do not have a preamp, the coaxial cable loss between the antenna and the receiver adds 1-to-1 on top of the receiver noise figure. If you add a preamp, yeah, you're increasing the signal and the noise, and then the coax loss drops them both, not just the signal. Back to Roy.
Okay, I mean, does that explain it enough for you, Wesley, tonight?
The way it is in the literature and the way that I understand it is this way. You have a signal from the antenna. It's not yet with added noise from the coax. You are amplifying that signal. And that would be exactly that as if you use the antenna without any amplifier, pre-amplifier, with higher dB gain. It's exactly the same. Now you're putting a certain amount of coax there and you're losing a certain amount of dB per meter or per 3 feet, whatever it is. And then, let me drop. At the end of the of that coax, you have a strong signal with whatever addition of the noise. Now, you try to amplify right at the end of the coax, where it's coming to the receiver, you're amplifying the existing noise and the small amount of signal that is left over. That's why you're putting amplifier, always. Whether this is a receiver or it's a transmitter, at the antenna, that's the best you can do. But most of us, including our transceivers, we have our amplifiers for the transmitter next to the coax cable. And to XGN.
Actually, if you put the transmitter at the antenna, you get the same benefit. That's what the Aegis radar system does.
Absolutely agree. You're right.
Okay, very good. So we're all in fine agreement. Anyone with any other points that they want to make on this subject tonight? Okay, if not that, then is there any other technical question that anyone wants to ask tonight? You know, sometimes people come late. We do have about a half hour before the space report. So if anyone has any technical questions or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please feel free. Just give me your call sign and your first name.
Hello, Delta 2 Uniform Hotel Bravo. My name is Jack, and today I just installed my mobile magnetic mount antenna, and then I routed it through the driver's side door, and then I noticed there's a little dent where where the door closes on the cable, RG58. And then my question is, is that tiny dent gonna make a difference in receiving or transmitting?
Okay, I'm assuming that by dent you mean that the coaxial cable is kind of squeezed tight together and slightly deformed from its circular shape?
Oh, that's correct.
Yeah, I've been doing that for decades, Roy. It's never been a problem.
Yeah, I think the answer ultimately is how extreme the case. In real life activities, you are not going to place the enormous amount of foot pounds on that thing in order to disrupt the dielectric and cause a significant impedance mismatch and reflections and such. So as Ed mentioned, in practical terms, it shouldn't give you any trouble. The only problem with that is the waterproofing of your car might be somewhat undermined. So keep in mind that that's a weak spot for rain to come in.
Okay, that answers my question. Kilo Delta 2, Uniform Hotel Bravo.
Very interesting question, but I have a problem with that.
Okay, Wesley, what's your problem with this one?
You have a pipe, and you have a dent in pipe. Water pipe. The amount of water flowing through that pipe is different than if it would be not a deformed pipe. The same would be with impedance. If one point of the coaxial cable has a different impedance, then affects the whole coaxial cable. And the coaxial cable is based on the geometry of coaxial. And impedance of the cable is based on geometry of coaxial cable. Interesting.
WB2EAV will comment on both water and RF.
Okay, very good. I will hand it over to you, Ed. Again, I think it's order of magnitude. I think the situation is not going to cause much in the way of reflection. If you think of it, a simple UHF connection is not really a nominal 50 ohm impedance, but because it is such a small length of slightly different impedance, the ultimate effect and impact is negligible. But Ed, please tell us.
With a water pipe, the dent will change laminar flow to turbulent flow, which will cause a significant increase in head and decrease in flow, yes. And regarding a coax, if you distort the shield, yes, you will change the characteristic impedance. And it is measurable, yes. It's also, I have found, not enough to be of any practical significance. If the fact that your SWR goes from 1.2 to 1.3, you're never going to see that in the real world. Is it measurable? Yes. Is it significant? I've never found it to be so.
I must agree with you. But then, remember that coax balloon that is at the end of the antenna sometimes put like a big round of table that is make like a circle? Interesting.
From a Smith chart?
They have an antenna and you have a coaxial cable, and sometimes in some antennas you actually take two winds of that coaxial cable at the end of that antenna. Did you ever see that?
Never on mobile installation.
Yes, never on mobile installation. That's the way.
I'm not sure what you're alluding to. I mean, there is the good old ugly balun, which is basically just coils of coaxial. It's usually more than...
That is correct. But there is a reason of doing that. And we talk about the formation of the coil, but we may also say we talk about using coil for the certain application. Address you.
Well, yes, I mean, it will deform it, but not to a great degree, and there are some types of coax that are a little bit less capable of dealing with it, that they have wider turning ratios, so if you force a more narrow turning ratio, you might have more problems, but, you know, as Ed mentioned, these things, yes, they do have an effect. Do they have a significant effect? In most cases in the real world, no. So, you know, there's enough things to worry about in this life.
On the other hand, if you cut the coax clean in half, it will have a significant effect.
I agree, and if you cut the pipe in half, and I've had that happen to me, as I talked up here in my basement got flooded, you can have a significant effect as well.
That was a good one. Okay, we must agree. It is noticeable, it is not significant, and at HF frequencies. Now, before 1.2, above 1.2 gigahertz is a different story.
Well, I would nitpick and say that it is measurable. I don't think Jack will notice the difference, personally.
Agreed.
Okay, we're all in agreement tonight. Jeez, if we only ran the UN.
Do you still remember how I was fighting with John, and we were good friends? That's what the discussion is about, because it makes people learn.
I agree with you, Wesley. It stimulates the conversation. If people just go around saying, yeah, you're right, yeah, you're right, yeah, you're right, it doesn't go very far. You know, if you have nothing better to do later tonight or someday, check out the chat room. It's rather fascinating how it had a life of its own tonight as well. So the more the merrier. I just wish everyone had access to a radio. We had a person who's on IRLP and couldn't receive. Another gentleman just got his license, and hopefully he'll be on the TechNet in weeks to come. But the more the merrier.
If you don't mind, I would like to remind, I was mentioning a few weeks ago about NMR amplifiers, and I have one, 300 watts, with power delivered only approximately 20 milliwatts, and it's completely linear. It's amazing. Those amplifiers could be sometime purchased very cheap, because people don't know what to do with it. And so this is an incredible amplifier, an extremely good one. If somebody pays attention to the opportunity center here. And one more thing. The amplifier that I have is from 5 megahertz to 300 megahertz, but actually works good on 450, 460 megahertz. So from 5 megahertz to 460 megahertz, and it gives coverage for all of the bands there. A class, and to Asia.
Well, it's a fascinating type of equipment, and you have to be a very smart shopper, because if you were to buy it at the original price, It would pain you. It certainly would pain me. So, you know, it's an interesting thing to play around with. Is there anything that you're particularly planning to use it for?
As a neck wave, that's what it was purchased for. I paid for it $80. Yeah, $80. The original price, $67,000. Interaction.
So, okay, it shows that you're a very good shopper and that anyone else who wanted to buy it brand new off the shelf would either have to be part of a business that has an open-ended budget or a very wealthy guy with a lot of money to spend.
I believe when you go to eBay, you're going to find a big prices for it still for the pocket of average Joe, which would be a few thousand dollars. But if you look at amplifiers, NMR amplifiers, inside the junk that is offered for sale, you may buy the whole NMR for just cost of junk, per kilogram, whatever, I mean per pound. Or sometimes, like it happened to me, the offer was sent to me, asking me if I wanted to pay $100 for it. I'm sorry, no, I didn't pay $80. $80 was with the tax, so it was less than that. So yes, there are plenty of opportunities, and I believe plenty of that stuff is there. The only thing you need to remember is, when you open up, most of that thing has the preamp and amp. The amp could be 700 watts, 1 kilowatt, or like in my situation is 300 watts. But the preamp is connected to it, and the preamp cannot tolerate more than 30 milliwatts, and no more than 1 volt. You put one and a little bit more than that, and you blow it. And it's damaged. And it's so nicely done inside, so extremely well, that it is like a crime. It's like a sin to damage it. So what I did is I disconnected the preamp and I connected directly to the amp. But because I don't know what is the driving power for the amp without the preamp, then I have to measure what is coming out from the amp to make sure that I'm really not overdriving it.
Okay, or you could have driven the preamp and seen what kind of signal strength it outputs.
That is correct. I didn't do it yet. Yes, I should do it. So when I was driving it with, let's say, 20 milliwatts would give me a preamp, an output of preamp, certain amount of power. This way I would know how much I can, if I try to bypass it, not use it, is how much power I can deliver to the input of the amplifier. And the amplifier is, even the box is extremely big and heavy, the amplifier, just the physical amplifier, is like 2 inches by 10 inches by 10 inches. That's it. The rest is that what they put because of the special application NMR.
Wait a minute, Wesley, does that have ALC?
I have no idea. Be honest, I don't have a schematic for it.
Just be careful. If it has ALC turned on, it might be fighting you and distorting your measurements.
Yeah, thank you for that, telling me that. I didn't even think about it. Yes, you might be absolutely right. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, short of reading the schematic and translating it, one way I would assume that you could check if it was the ALC or something working just like it is to bring up the power slowly and taking a look at the gain curve. When you hit the ALC is where it would become nonlinear. So that might be a point. But, you know, have fun with it. It sounds very interesting. I never really worked with nuclear magnetic resonance test equipment. I did work with gas chromatographers and mass chromatography, and I even saw one mass chromatography setup that fit into a suit.